deeply involved in this.
Welcome, everybody. I will call the Joint Committee on Implementation of Measure 91 to order. All puns need to be taken care of in everyone's first paragraph, and I just took care of mine. This is a very exciting committee. It's a real statement that the leadership placed so much importance on implementing recreational marijuana correctly that they actually formed a special committee. So I wanted to start by just going over some of the ground rules. We meet on Monday and Wednesday evening. We start at 5, we end at 7, and we will start on time and end on time. It's very difficult to accommodate an evening meeting into our schedules, and so that we don't actually kill ourselves or you, we will be very punctual, both beginning and ending. And I've made that promise to my committee members. Once the public hearings begin, we will make every effort to pace the issues so that everyone who wants to speak has an opportunity to speak. You might expect some time limitations if there are a lot of people in the room, but we will make every effort to accommodate everyone who wants to speak, and we will observe the usual courtesy of giving priority to people who have traveled more than 100 miles, which we expect a fair number of those in this committee. We are fortunate here to have Adam Crawford as our committee administrator. Adam was the committee administrator for the House Committee on Energy and Environment in the 2013 session and is very excited to be back because he doesn't actually know what he's gotten into in this new assignment. And over there is our committee assistant. We have Joshua Flam, who is a recent transplant to Oregon, very excited to be here, and a recent graduate from the University of Illinois. So I'm going to start out today in our first session by asking our members to give a brief introduction of themselves and to maybe say a few words about what their expectations and hopes are for this committee, maybe how they ended up here, if they wish. So I will start that process by recognizing Senator Cruz at the end to say a few words.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, Southwestern Oregon. Actually, Senator Przanski and I have been involved in the medical marijuana program since its inception. The first session we dealt with it was in 99, and we have kind of been in the center of that all the way through up till now. I would say if my two expectations out of the work we do here, one would be to get the cartels out of the state of Oregon, number one, and number two, to protect the validity of the medical marijuana program.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Senator Beyer.
Lee Beyer. I represent Central Lane and Linn counties. I don't have any clear expectations. I'm here to learn, listen, and work on the issue. And my perspective is the voters have spoken on it, and it's our job to try and figure out how to make it work in Oregon.
Thank you. Senator Przanski, I'm sure, will be joining us, but Senator Ferrioli?
I'm Senator Ted Ferrioli, District 30, all are part of 11 counties, mostly east of the Cascades. The district starts in Marion County and proceeds to the Idaho-Nevada border, encompassing more incorporated cities and more counties than any other district in Oregon. Most of the counties that I represent did not support Measure 91. Many of those jurisdictions are concerned about the implementation, but I believe that Oregonians voted overwhelmingly to end prohibition. So that is what I'm going to be very interested in working on and to help the committee do that. I'm also very interested in helping those communities get to the answers to their questions about how the time, place, and manner for marijuana outlets can be managed. And I'll be encouraging them to understand that if they pursue a ban under their regulatory authority, they may be encouraging bootlegging in their communities rather than combating bootlegging, and that will be counterproductive to ending prohibition. So that's sort of a line that we need to follow to find the right answers. So in addition to time, place, and manner issues, I'm going to be interested in knowing, as I do know from my conversations with growers, some of them, which were affiliated with medical marijuana facilities, scrupulously followed the regulations that were set forth for accounting for the product, for fulfilling all of the obligations under the medical marijuana program, which I believe is compassionate and a necessary program. Some did not, and I'll be interested in learning from the committee how we're able to discern the difference between those who followed the rules and those who did not follow the rules.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly. To the other end of the podium, we'll recognize Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ken Helm. I'm representative from District 34, which is a district that's composed of parts of Beaverton, Rock Creek, and the neighborhoods of West Haven and Cedar Hills in the Portland area. I'm a land use attorney by trade. This is my first position in any sort of elected office, and I asked to be on this committee. I asked to be on this committee because I think it's going to be one of the historic pieces of law that our state becomes noted for in the future, much like our land use laws, our bottle bill, and our beach bill. Just for some statistics, my district approved the measure by 61% of the vote. So the folks in my part of the world more or less overwhelmingly wanted this measure to pass. And because I'm a new legislator, and this is sort of a unique committee, and I'll be learning a lot as we go, my initial approach to our work will fall back on my experience as an appellate lawyer. And in appellate law, we're always looking to discover the intent of the drafters so that we can correctly interpret individual provisions and apply them correctly. And so when I looked back at the actual measure that we passed in December, I first looked to the purposes statement and then another statement that actually includes some promises to the state. Some of those promises were not to change existing employment law. Another promise was to not change in any way landlord-tenant laws.
Representative Hill, if I could interrupt you just for a second, we're going to be getting detailed testimony on this in a minute.
Well, I'll finish up quickly. The other area is that we not change in any way the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. And so what I would like the committee to think about, and I'll be thinking about hard as we move forward, is when we change the operational components of this act to try to make it work better, we need to refer back to those purpose statements continually so that we ensure that we are creating, in the end, a statute that is internally consistent and can be rationally applied in the real world. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity, and I will not be as long-winded. Sorry. It's just got to start it out right, you know. Okay.
When can I apply to move my seat?
You know, I'm really interested, Andy Olson, state representative out of the Albany area, and actually you and I, Peter, this is our sixth term we start. we're worried. Okay. So anyhow, I'm interested in consistency. I'm also very interested in what do we do with the marketing side of it, too, especially, you know, as the potential of the attraction to children, that type thing. I honestly think I do not want to hear the same problems that Colorado is experiencing right now. So
thank you.
Those are hot.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Peter Buckley. I represent Ashland and South Jackson County in the legislature. And everything that President Helms said does apply, at least my approach, too. My district also overwhelmingly voted in favor. And, of course, they sent me here to make sure that do everything I can to make sure the marijuana in Oregon is organic and GMO-free. My expectations, my desire are to implement Measure 91 faithfully, and any changes that impact the medical marijuana program. I'm not sure how we do this without impacting in some way the medical marijuana program, but the any changes in terms of streamlining processes or testing, et cetera, that to be done with the support of the medical marijuana patients of the state of Oregon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you again.
I'm Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass, Cave Junction, and Williams, Oregon. I've expanded my district because I have a lot of good friends now in Williams and Cave Junction. It's been a pleasure to meet them. I am looking forward to this committee. I asked to be able to do it, and I'm looking forward to faithfully enacting Measure 91. I think we should be extremely careful to shred the tenets of 91. We need to be careful to maintain the intent. Obviously, there are lots of connecting parts that don't connect right now, and that will be, I think, one of the biggest jobs that we have. Initially, when I got the job, I began hearing from people who use the product. Then I began to hear those who grow the product. And then I began to hear from the people who own property adjoining grows, who are noticing that there really isn't anything advocating for them in Measure 91 or protecting them. So we've got a big job. I really hope this committee swings for the fences. I want to accomplish as much as we can. Goodness knows there will be fixes on this for years. But I say swing for the fences now, get as much right as we can from the beginning, and thankfully we have two states to use as perhaps a gauge in what we do like and what we don't like. So we look forward to hearing from all of you as we put that together. Thank you.
Thank you. And now my honorable co-chair, Ann Leininger.
Thanks. I'm Ann Leininger. I represent Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, but I'm from Southern Oregon. And as a kid, we used to go out into the woods a lot and pick huckleberries and go mushroom hunting and hike around. And I remember at one point my mom said to me, you know, you've got to be really careful where you go nowadays outside, because if you stumble into an illegal grow, you could get shot. And there are a lot of those. So I was a supporter of Measure 91 because I think it's really important for us to make sure that we get marijuana off of our public lands and have it in a safe and regulated and controlled environment. I'm a mother of two young teenagers, in addition to representing Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland. So a big priority for me is going to be to make sure that we are regulating edibles and marketing to kids and access to kids in a way that's going to keep our young people safe. I think we should invest in some prevention, marijuana use prevention programs for kids. We've got to focus on that element. I'm a business attorney, and I see this as a really important economic opportunity for the state of Oregon. It complements beautifully the artisan food and beverage sectors that we have. I think that the hemp part of Measure 91 opens up some really important economic activity doors for us. We're going to have some work to do around helping operationalize this business opportunity, and I'm really excited about hearing from people on that. And then last of all, I'm going to bring to this my experience as a new legislator, but as someone entering my sixth year of elected service. I was a Clackamas County Commissioner before this, and I have a couple of lessons that I have learned through my elected service. And one of those is that voters really like it when you do the thing they asked you to do. So that's one of the things that I'm going to take to this as I interpret how we should work with Measure 91. The second is, if Cover Oregon taught us nothing else, I hope it taught us that you don't always have to define a problem in the very most complex way possible before you try to solve it. In that regard, I mean, I'm not dying to merge medical and adult use commercial right now. I think that that's not necessary. I think that that takes on a lot more than we need to take on at this moment. And third, that we need to treat one another with respect and courtesy even when we disagree. And I certainly think above all else we need to treat members of the community who come and testify before this committee with the dignity that they deserve from the people who work for them.
Thank you. And I am Ginny Burdick. I represent Senate District 18, which covers parts of Northwest Portland, Southwest Portland, and Tigard. I'm brand new to the marijuana issue, lacking the advantage my co-chair had of actually having worked on the campaign. So for the past month, I've been in a crash course on all things marijuana. I've been in grows, I've been in dispensaries, I've been in labs. I've talked to people, many of the people in this room, at great length. Thank you very much for your patience. And from all this experience of the past month, I've come away encouraged and hopeful that we in Oregon have the talent and the commitment to pull off a successful implementation of this new program. So here are just a few of the things I've learned. We have medical marijuana growers in Oregon who are really, really good at it. The people I've talked to in the growing community are not only good at it, but the ones I've talked to are very committed to making our legal market a success and starving out the black market as much as humanly possible. Medical marijuana card holders do include a very vulnerable population that we must take strong steps to protect. There's a real entrepreneurial spirit in Oregon. I see very, very sharp business people interested in this work and already doing this work at all levels. But perhaps the most important thing that I've learned from my recent visit in Colorado with my co-chair over there is the importance of welcoming all Oregonians to the table, inside and outside of the marijuana community. So my goal as co-chair is to provide a safe and welcoming environment for all points of view as we pull together for policies and solutions that work for all Oregonians. I really want Oregon to be the model for what I see as a national trend in this direction. I want people to look to Oregon and say, my gosh, that's a system that really works. And I think we have the right team to do this. I'm very pleased that our leadership saw fit to give this issue the importance I think it deserves. And I really look forward to our journey ahead. So thank you all for being here. And now we will start with our formal agenda, which begins with an organizational meeting to adopt committee rules. Council.
Madam Co-Chairs, member of the committee, the Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91, the committee rules are in front of you. What you'll notice is very similar to what the other committee rules are, namely the major change between last year and this year is that before a committee can take action on amendments, those amendments must be on OLIS at least 1 hour. We can discuss the amendments, but we can't move the amendments prior to that 1 hour. I would also make note that as a joint committee, we will need a majority of both House and Senate members to move a bill. If we have five House members and one Senate member voting in the affirmative, the measure will fail. So,
okay, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 4th, 2015.
Senator Farioli has moved to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 4th, 2015. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I sincerely appreciate the inclusion of the change for the posting of amendments on OLIS for a minimum of 1 hour. I will tell you that that is not enough time for any measure with this kind of complexity, but it was the best we could get. I'd much prefer amendments, if we're to do this in a thoughtful manner, be available 24 hours, which is well within the capability of our operational procedures, because it meets or exceeds the 1 hour rule. Right. But as soon as members are satisfied that an amendment meets the constitutional requirements, they should be posted on OLIS no matter what that hour is, whether it's 1 hour or 24, so that folks that are following this issue here in the building and all over the state of Oregon have a chance to see what the committee is considering before we literally 59 minutes later vote on things. So, Madam Chair, I understand the necessity of the 1 hour. Well, I appreciate the fact that we're posting, but I would encourage us to post as early as possible. And that concludes my discussion, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you. And I will point out that 1 hour is a minimum. We will try to exceed that substantially whenever possible. The 1 hour may become necessary in the fast and furious deliberations which are coming down the pike. But I completely agree with you, Senator Farioli. The earlier the better, because there are a lot of people interested in this issue. So is there further discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. Okay, now we will move into our substantive part of our meeting. So I will open an informational meeting. Adam, do you want to say anything about our plans here, or do you want to just start calling people up?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, the informational meeting before us today will be primarily discussing marijuana legalization in the U.S., marijuana legalization as it applies to the state of Oregon, as well as some discussions regarding federal law and the Ogden Poll memos.
Great. Okay, we have our beginning witnesses are Mark Mayer and Shannon O'Fallon. Mark Mayer from the Deputy Legislative Council and Shannon O'Fallon, who's a Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Oregon Department of Justice. Welcome.
Thank you.
And even though I said that, you still have to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger, members of the committee, I'm Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. You asked Shannon O'Fallon and I to come testify to provide some context for Measure 91. We discussed how we wanted to break this up, and we decided that I would primarily address the context of state laws regulating marijuana within the federal context and the Controlled Substances Act, and then she would address the particularities of both Measure 91 and the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. So I'll go ahead and I'll start with the federal program at this federal CSA, talk a little bit about that, and then I'll hand it over to Shannon. Try to make my comments as brief as possible, and I'll try to provide as much context as possible. The important thing to remember is that these are going to be some guidelines to remember as you set about your task of figuring out what you want the law to look like and how you want to regulate marijuana. And it's probably best to begin by separating out how you think about state law and federal law into two different compartments. One would be federal enforcement of the Controlled Substances Act, and the other would be preemption issues. And you could think of the first one as the arm of the federal government that is administrative or executive, and whether or not they're going to enforce the provisions of the CSA. Then the other one is how the federal courts, or even the Oregon Supreme Court or other Oregon appellate courts, are going to look at the CSA provisions and the provisions of any law providing for the regulation of marijuana. So those are the two things. I'm going to concentrate mainly on the enforcement piece because I think that that's probably of most importance to you guys, and then at the very end I'll address a little bit of the preemption piece. So as probably everybody on this committee knows, the CSA, Federal Controlled Substances Act, it does prohibit manufacture, delivery, and possession of marijuana. It places marijuana in Schedule 1, and there are very few exceptions to the possession, delivery, and manufacture of any Schedule 1 drug underneath the CSA. They have to be an approved research program in order for that to occur. Thing to remember is this is a federal law, it's not a state law, so those prohibitions are federal in nature. The other thing to remember is that there have been a long line of cases, and I'm not going to go over them right now, ending with Reich v. Gonzalez, that have looked at whether or not the federal government could enforce CSA provisions in states that have provided for, mainly in the medical marijuana context, regulation of medical marijuana. And those cases have concluded that, yes, Commerce Clause does give them that power. So federal government has the power to enforce the provisions of the CSA in Oregon. That said, there is some guidance that states can look at, like Colorado, Washington, Oregon, as to what kind of regulations they can impose in order to create a system where the federal government is not going to do that currently. That guidance comes mainly from what is commonly called the Cole Memorandum. I believe I sent a copy of that to Adam Crawford today, and he posted it on OLIS. So you should have a copy of that on OLIS, and each one of you should probably have a copy of that in your email boxes. The Cole Memorandum is meant to provide guidance for United States Department of Justice activity. There's two things to remember that it doesn't do before I move on to say what it does do. First thing is it doesn't distinguish between civil proceedings and criminal prosecutions. This Cole Memorandum provides guidance for all Department of Justice activity, not just criminal prosecutions. The second thing to remember is that the Cole Memorandum does not distinguish between state laws providing for the regulation of marijuana for non-medical purposes, such as Measure 91, or state laws providing for the regulation of marijuana for medical purposes, such as the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. Cole Memorandum priorities apply to all state laws regulating marijuana. What it does do is it establishes some basic guidelines. Let me back up. That would probably be the wrong way to word it. What it does do is it establishes some basic priorities that the United States Department of Attorneys are going to look United States Department of Justice attorneys are going to look at when they're deciding what to investigate and what to prosecute. And what that translates into for you guys is some basic guidelines to follow when you're thinking about regulation. The Cole Memorandum does reiterate Congress's determination that marijuana is a Schedule I drug, and it does state that illegal distribution and sale of marijuana is a crime, and that it provides a significant source of revenue to large-scale criminal enterprises, gangs, and cartels. It does all those things. It also states the United States Department of Justice is committed to using its investigative and prosecutorial resources to address the most significant threats presented by this type of activity. And then it also emphasizes there has to be an effective, consistent rationale in these prosecutions and investigations. Then what it does is it establishes eight priorities for these attorneys to follow in conducting investigations and prosecutions. I'll briefly go over each of these eight because they provide the large picture, the big picture as to, you know, what are we going to want to concentrate on when we're looking at this law and what we want to do with it. Number one, preventing the distribution of marijuana to minors. Number two, preventing revenue from sale of marijuana from going to criminal enterprises, gangs, and cartels. Three, preventing the diversion of marijuana from states where it is legal under state law in some form to other states. Preventing state-authorized marijuana activity from being used as a cover or pretext for the trafficking of other illegal drugs or illegal activity. Preventing violence and the use of firearms in the cultivation and distribution of marijuana. Preventing drugged driving and the exacerbation of other adverse public health consequences. Preventing growing of marijuana on public lands and the attendant public safety environmental dangers posed by marijuana production on public lands. And finally, preventing marijuana possession or use on federal property. By way of example, and I'm not suggesting here that Measure 91 is exhaustive or that, you know, there's no policy considerations, but there are provisions in Measure 91 that address some of these things, and I'll go over those by way of example of how a state law can be address some of these concerns. Measure 91 specifies that a person under the age of 21 may not produce, process, or keep or store homegrown marijuana. Prohibits applicants under the age of 21 from being licensed as producers, processors, wholesalers, or retailers. Prohibits licensees from allowing a person under age of 21 to consume marijuana or to be on the licensee's premises. Prohibits a person under the age of 21 from purchasing or attempting to purchase marijuana. To prevent marijuana from being diverted to states where marijuana is not legal, it prohibits importing or exporting of marijuana. And to prevent revenue from the sale of marijuana from going to criminal enterprises, gangs, and cartels, it specifies that marijuana producers, processors, and wholesalers may deliver marijuana only to licensed premises. I could give you the exact section numbers for each of those if you would like. Again, I'm not trying to say that the provisions of 91 are exhaustive by any means. That's for you guys to decide as the policymakers. However, there are examples of how it tackles some of these priorities. And in fact, I think the priorities listed in the Cole Memorandum were part of the part of the findings of Measure 91 adopted by the people. Moving right along, I would point out that the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act also addresses some of these priorities. It doesn't address the same priorities, but you could also look at existing provisions in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, and it does have some of these it does address some of these as well. For instance, under the dispensary law 475.314 subsection 8, a registered medical marijuana facility may not transfer any tetrahydrocannabinol-infused product that is meant to be swallowed or inhaled unless the product is packaged in child-resistant safety packaging that meets standards established by the Oregon Health Authority. And a registered medical marijuana facility may not transfer any tetrahydrocannabinol-infused product that is manufactured or packaged in a manner that is attractive to minors as determined by the Oregon Health Authority by rule. So there are examples in existing law of how these priorities can be addressed. I could, of course, point anybody on the committee to those types of provisions or assist them in figuring out what has been addressed or has not. Some of these provisions are comparable between the two programs, and some of them aren't. So you might want to take a look at that and see if that is an issue. Real briefly, I know I'm running out of time, but I did want to talk very briefly about a second memorandum that I sent to Adam Crawford. He sent to everybody else today. It's also posted on OLIS. It's the Department of Treasury Financial Crimes Enforcement Network memorandum. The Bank Secrecy Act expectations regarding marijuana-related businesses. I'm not going to go into this too deeply at this time, but this memorandum outlines the Department of Treasury's guidelines for how financial institutions may provide services to marijuana operations. And there are actually some very complicated procedures involved with that. I could go into those in more detail if I had more time, but I think at this point I'm just going to mention very quickly that it tells financial institutions to assess the risk of engaging in one of these businesses, and it outlines how to assess that risk. What to pull away from that is that financial institutions and marijuana operations have to be very transparent with financial institutions in order to meet the guidelines of this particular memorandum. The memorandum states that financial institutions should verify that businesses are registered or licensed by state. They should review the application that the business submitted to the state. The memorandum states that financial institutions should request from state licensing authority any available information about the businesses and related parties, to develop an understanding of the normal and expected activity for the businesses, to monitor publicly available information about these businesses, and update all information related to marijuana operation on a periodic basis. So there has been a lot of interest in financing of these and how that can go about. There are some guidelines out there by the Department of Treasury. I would like to mention real quickly, though, that nothing is going to require a financial institution to engage in this type of financing, and it might be a pretty heavy lift. I think it has not worked in Colorado. Even though this memorandum came out a year ago, financial institutions are still largely not interested in financing operations at this time. However, they do set up some guidelines to consider when you're thinking about regulation. I did want to mention really quickly also, there are a couple of legal distinctions in how the federal law overlays between medical and recreational programs at this point. And there are some pretty strong legal arguments for why medical marijuana may be not subject to the CSA. That has not come out in court yet, but there are stronger legal arguments with that, mainly revolving around Fifth Amendment substantive due process rights. I can go into that more in more detail in a little bit in in later if you would like. There is also in the federal budget bill that was passed just last month, in December of 2014, federal House Bill 83, 113th Congress second session, there was direction in that House bill to the United States Department of Justice to not use its money to prosecute people who are operating under the scope and authority of a medical marijuana program. So currently, for the current federal fiscal cycle, the United States Department of Justice will not be using its money to prosecute people within a medical marijuana program. Okay. Real briefly, and I'm just going to touch on this very briefly, that's the enforcement piece. Think of that as being one compartment when you're considering this. These are guidelines to follow and to think about as you're developing policy. The second piece that I want to go over is just the preemption piece. And what we're left with at this point is we're left with, up with these two bookends. And on the one hand, underneath the 10th Amendment, underneath 10th Amendment jurisprudence, there is a strong argument that a state does not have to spend its money doing anything that it doesn't want to spend its money on. And if a state chooses to not spend its money prosecuting people for a certain activity just because it's a federal law or a federal prohibition, the state is not going to have to do that. The states are sovereigns, and they get to choose how to spend their money how they want to. You might want to think of that bookend as the decriminalization bookend. Unfortunately, the safest type of law related to marijuana legalization is straight up decriminalization, not regulation, because that would just be saying we're not going to spend our money on it anymore. We're not going to prosecute or send people to jail or spend our money on it anymore. I realize that's not the intent of 91, and it's not really palatable to most people. The other bookend comes from a case issued by the Oregon Supreme Court, Emerald Steel. The case is pretty complicated. It involves an employer and an employee who wanted to use medical marijuana while at work, and the employer said basically, no, I don't want you to do that, and the worker continued to do it. The employer let him go, and he filed an action against the employer saying, no, you have to allow me to do this under state law. That went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court basically said, no, the employer does not have to do that. And it issued a holding that I find to be pretty broad in application. That holding was that which state law allows and federal law prohibits is the state law is preempted by the CSA. Those are the two bookends. And just think about how everything in 91 and most of what I think most of what is in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, it falls somewhere in between. But when you're thinking about coming up with policy, we want to move toward not authorizing activity, we're regulating it. You're providing oversight. The more you move toward that end instead of authorization, then the safer the law is going to be. I think what Representative Helm said about two of the tenets of Measure 91, those are probably pretty good direction, which is it doesn't affect landlord-tenant law, doesn't affect employee-employer law, it doesn't authorize anything within those contexts. That's pretty good direction to take with regard to implementing policy. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Shannon O'Fallon to talk more about the state programs, unless there are specific questions. Are you guys taking questions today?
We'll take them after Shannon finishes. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger, Shannon O'Fallon with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm in the General Counsel Division. I've advised the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program for a number of years and helped OHA or advised OHA on implementation of the dispensary program when House Bill 3460 was enacted. So I'm going to quickly go through some highlights of Measure 91. I apologize if I'm telling you things that you already know, and then talk a little bit about the Medical Marijuana Act and go from there. So obviously Measure 91 permits OLCC to regulate the retail marijuana industry. It permits personal possession of certain amounts of marijuana for people that are over the age of 21, taxes a producer on the sale of marijuana flowers, leaves, and immature plants. And those provisions become operative on July 1st, 2015. So again, I think as Representative Helm said, some things the measure does not do, it specifically says that it's not meant to affect employment law, landlord-tenant law, the Medical Marijuana Act, and federal law. Clearly, it can't do that. One of the things to keep in mind when you're reviewing the measure is that the definitions are really important. So I'm going to just mention a few key ones. Marijuana items includes marijuana, which are all parts of the plant, marijuana products, and marijuana extracts. So it's those things, those marijuana items are the things that licensees can produce, process, and sell. As I said, marijuana is all parts of the plant, whether it's growing or not. A marijuana product is a product that contains marijuana or a marijuana extract intended for human consumption, but does not include marijuana by itself and does not include extract by itself. And marijuana extract is a product obtained by separating the resins from marijuana by using solvents other than vegetable glycerin, and you end up with a highly concentrated liquid. So if you're making a concentrate or extract with vegetable glycerin under the measure, that does not fall within the definition of extract. Marijuana flowers are only the flowers of the plant. Marijuana leaves are only the leaves of the plant and no other part. So when you're thinking about taxation, right, you tax the flowers and you tax the leaves, but that doesn't include any other part of the plant. Homegrown or homemade means grown or made by a person 21 years of age or older for non-commercial purposes. Usable marijuana is dried marijuana flowers and dried marijuana leaves and any mixture or preparation thereof. And usable marijuana is not really, that term is not used sort of in the licensure parts of the measure, but are mentioned when you're talking about home grows and how much you're allowed to personally possess. And there are definitions of a household and household unit, which also come into play when you're talking about how much you can, how much an individual can have. So the home grow marijuana provisions, so one or more persons 21 years or older that are in the same household can have 4 mature plants, 8 ounces of usable marijuana, 16 ounces of homemade marijuana products in solid form, so that's probably like an something that you would eat, and 72 ounces of homemade marijuana products in liquid form. Someone that's 21 years of age or older can deliver to someone else who's 21 or older 1 ounce of homegrown marijuana, 16 ounces of homemade marijuana products in solid form, and 72 ounces of marijuana products in liquid form. And individuals specifically cannot make or possess homemade extract as that's defined in the measure. So if you're making, again, making extract with vegetable glycerin, then you could do that at home. Okay, so moving on to OLCC's powers and duties. They're going to be regulating the purchase, sale, production, processing, transportation, and delivery of marijuana items. So issuing licenses, setting standards for licensees. They can grant, deny, suspend, or revoke a license. They're going to be collecting the taxes. They can investigate and aid in the prosecution of violations of Measure 91. They can establish standards for marijuana items, require the testing of marijuana items. They can, by rule, limit the quantity of marijuana items that can be purchased at any one time in order to prevent resale. So that might get at, you know, some of the things that are set out in the Cole memo. They can prohibit the sale of a brand of marijuana item if the OLCC believes that it's deceptively labeled or branded as to content or contains injurious or adulterated ingredients. They can regulate and prohibit the advertising of licensees, though, of course, you need to remember that the Oregon Constitution is going to put some limits on the extent to which it can do that. They can regulate the use of marijuana items for scientific, pharmaceutical, manufacturing, mechanical, industrial, or other purposes. And they are tasked with presenting a report to the legislature and to make recommendations to you about changes in the vehicle code regarding driving under the influence of marijuana, and that is due on or before January 1st, 2017. OLCC is required to begin accepting applications for all licensed categories on or before January 4th, 2016. So that's their deadline for that. The production of marijuana is, of course, you know, the growing of marijuana. Processing is generally defined as taking marijuana and making it into some other product, though the definition also includes the packaging and labeling of marijuana. So it could be that any licensee, as the measure stands now, any licensee that's going to do any packaging or labeling would also have to get a processor license. Retailers are the only licensee that can sell to a consumer. And a consumer is defined as a person who purchases, acquires, owns, holds, or uses marijuana items other than for purposes of resale. There's also a wholesale license, and that is not very well described in the measure, but you have to have a wholesale license for a premises where marijuana items are received, kept, stored, or delivered. You can hold multiple licenses, so I guess unlike on the liquor side, you can be a producer and a processor and a retailer. A license is a personal privilege. It doesn't constitute property under the measure. It's valid for a year and is renewed annually. It can be transferred to another premises subject to OLCC's rules. It ceases upon death. The fees are set out in the measure as a $250 non-refundable application fee and a $1,000 non-refundable license fee. And then again, that's going to be due yearly. On the dispensary side, OLCC has set those OHA has set those fees in rule. It's a $500 application fee and a $3,500 license fee, so just to distinguish those. Taxes, as I said, are on the flowers, leaves, and plants. It's $35 per ounce on flowers, $10 per ounce on leaves, $5 for an immature plant. And that tax is levied at the point where the producer is selling those things to another licensee. There is a provision after July 1st, 2017 for those rates to be adjusted according to cost of living. That's something that OLCC can do. And then the commission is supposed to regularly review the rates and make recommendations to the legislature regarding whether or not the rates should be changed in order to maximize net revenue, minimize the illegal marijuana industry, and discourage the use of marijuana by minors under the age of 21. And I can go into how the funds are distributed if you would like. Should I go over that, or are you familiar enough with that?
How do you feel, committee? I think you can probably
keep going. Okay. So at the end of the month, OLCC is supposed to certify the amount of monies available for distribution into what's called the Oregon Marijuana Account. It withholds funds necessary to carry out its obligations, and then it distributes monies as follows. It's 40% to the Common School Fund, 20% to the Mental Health, Alcoholism, and Drug Services account, 15% to the State Police account, 10% to assist local law enforcement, and that's distributed to cities in shares that the measure lays out that I won't go into, and then 10% for law enforcement in counties, again, according to a share calculation, and 5% to the Oregon Health Authority for drug and alcohol abuse prevention, early intervention, and treatment. So moving on to some local government issues, cities and counties can adopt reasonable time, place, and manner ordinances related to the nuisance aspects of marijuana retailers. It appears that it's limited to retailers and not other licensees. If they make specific findings that the establishment would cause adverse effects to occur. Measure 91 says that it preempts local ordinances that are inconsistent with it. A city or county can prohibit the operation of licensed premises if they get a petition signed by not less than 10% of the electors in the city or county at a general election. And so the soonest that would be November 2016. Some of the prohibitions that the measure calls out, some of which Mark already mentioned, but it's a Class C felony to import or export marijuana items for consideration. It's a Class A misdemeanor to import or export without consideration. You can't give marijuana away as a prize. You can't sell to someone who's visibly intoxicated. Only a licensed producer can possess a mature marijuana plant, so processors and retailers can't sell mature plants. You can't use marijuana or consume marijuana in a public place, and that's defined in the measure. All right, so that's sort of my highlight of Measure 91, and I'll move into the Medical Marijuana Act then. So the Medical Marijuana Program, which is sort of the card-issuing arm of OHA, is administered by the Oregon Health Authority. Cards can be issued to a patient, someone with one of the qualifying medical conditions. A patient can apply by filling out an application and having an attending physician statement that says that the individual has been diagnosed with a debilitating condition and that medical use of marijuana may mitigate the symptoms or effects of the person's debilitating medical condition. So it's not a prescription that they're getting from their physician. The conditions are cachexia, severe pain, nausea, severe nausea, seizures, including seizures caused by epilepsy, persistent muscle spasms, and PTSD, which was just added recently. I think there's an Alzheimer's one that's not on here, but in any case. A patient can designate a primary caregiver who's defined as someone 18 years of age or older who has significant responsibility for managing the well-being of the patient. The patient can grow for themselves, or they can have a third party grow for them, which could be their caregiver or someone else altogether. The address for the grow site has to be registered with the OMMP. You can also apply for a card if you're a parent or legal guardian for your child, so minors can get cards. The fee for an OMMP card is $200 unless you qualify for a reduced fee. If a patient's application is granted, then the OMMP issues cards to the patient, the caregiver, and the grower. And there's also a card that's supposed to be posted at an authorized grow site. Cards are renewed annually. The possession limits under the OMMA are 6 mature plants, 18 seedlings or starts, and 24 ounces of usable marijuana. So that's at any one time, you know, a patient or a patient caregiver and grower sort of collectively can have that much. If a patient's been convicted of certain controlled substances crimes, then that the amount they can have gets limited for 5 years to an ounce. A grower can grow up for 4 patients at a time. Caregivers can have as many patients. There's no limit on the number of patients a caregiver can have. Under the Medical Marijuana Act, marijuana is considered the property of the patient. So if a patient says, I don't want you to grow for me anymore, the grower is supposed to return the marijuana to the patient. So while a grower can only grow for 4 people, there's no limit on the number of growers that can grow at any one location. Okay. So the dispensary, generally the medical marijuana information, cardholder information is confidential, but law enforcement can, either using LEDS, which is an automated system, or calling the program, can verify whether or not someone has a card, whether or not an address is a registered grow site. And if they're talking to someone in person, the program will provide them enough information so they could tell whether or not they're in compliance with number of plants. So they would say, you know, is John Smith a registered grower? And the program would say, yes, he is, and he's a grower for, you know, 3 people. So then they would know how many plants John Smith was authorized to have. That's sort of how it works. Okay. On the dispensary side, the dispensary program is also administered by the Oregon Health Authority, but it's a separate program. It became operative in March 1st of 2014. A person responsible for a facility, what we call a PRF, can apply to be registered. In order to be registered, you have to be a resident of Oregon. You can't have been convicted of certain crimes. The proposed location cannot be within 1,000 feet of a school or within 1,000 feet of another registered dispensary. It has to be zoned in an area that's commercial, industrial, mixed use, or agricultural land. You have to be a business registered with the Secretary of State and comply with OHA's rules about security, and you have to test marijuana for pesticides, mold, and mildew. Dispensaries can get marijuana from a grower, caregiver, or patient if the patient is authorized that transfer, and then they can transfer only to a patient or a caregiver. I already talked about the fees. The confidentiality provisions are a little bit the same. The identity of the PRF and the location of the dispensary are confidential under state law, but law enforcement can get access to that information, and it's also the case that OHA asks if dispensaries are willing to waive confidentiality, and so you'll see on the website there's a list of dispensaries who have waived confidentiality, so you can see who's registered. And Mark already talked about the Senate Bill 1531 that was passed in 2014, allowed cities and counties to enact some year-long moratoriums and also put in some additional regulations around packaging and child-resistant manufacturing and child-resistant packaging. Okay. Sorry, that was a little long.
But we need it. Just to clarify one thing, that the caregivers have no limit on how many medical patients they can have. Is that correct?
Right.
So if the caregiver is also the grower, then they could grow?
They can only grow for four, Chair Burdick. Sorry. Right. So as a caregiver, unless you're the authorized grower, you can't grow. But if you are designated also as a grower, then you fall within the limit of four, of only being able to grow for four.
But a caregiver can be a grower?
A caregiver could be a grower.
Yes.
So it would be a dual role.
So a caregiver could grow for any number of patients?
No, only if the caregiver is a grower, a designated grower, they can only grow for four.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
But they can be caregiver for more than that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Chair Burdick, thank you to the panel. So how does a dispensary, or from who does a dispensary get its marijuana from?
Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger, Representative Wilson, they get marijuana from, I mean, generally it's a grower, I think. So a patient can authorize their grower to transfer excess marijuana to a particular dispensary. And there's a form that they fill out and they sign, and they have to specify what dispensary it's going to go to. They can set limits if they want to limit how much the grower can send. And then it doesn't necessarily have to be the grower that delivers it. It does have to be a cardholder that delivers the marijuana, but that's how it works.
Okay. Good.
Other questions from the committee? Senator Farrelly.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. First for Mr. Meyer, you gave us a great side-by-side comparison of Measure 91 and the Cole Memorandum, and I wondered if you could provide those notes for the committee, because I have a sense that if you had a matrix and a side-by-side comparison, they wouldn't overlap completely. There'd be points of agreement and points where the issues either aren't dealt with or there are points of disagreement. I think that'd be very helpful for me to see how Measure 91 comports with the Cole Amendment. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, follow up to Ms. O'Fallon. Likewise, you were testifying from notes, and you did a great job, I believe, of enumerating the rights and responsibilities to various parties. I think that'd be extremely helpful for me to have as we go, you know, into this process, because you know, that is a distillation of intelligence, and I, you know, I'm not as energetic or as intelligent, so I would like to have that matrix, if you don't mind.
If that's available, we would the whole committee would appreciate.
Sure, we had you know, sort of short notice, and so I will put that in. In a little bit nicer, more formal form.
Okay.
And we also have sort of a table that we've worked up that shows the differences between the medical marijuana side, the retail, and then the home grow that we can provide.
That'd be great. Yeah.
And Madam Chair, this was another for Mr. Meyer. If I'm not mistaken, you basically indicated that we might have a preemption issue that's not been fully explored by the courts. You know, or the court has held that in point of fact, federal law does preempt the state law in this case. So which is it, Mr. Manager?
Co-Vice Chair, Senator Farioli, I think that, again, I think the important thing to remember is that these are their bookends, like I said, and we do have a holding from the Oregon Supreme Court as to when a federal law preempts a state law, but we also have very strong 10th Amendment jurisprudence. And I think that what you want to do when you're considering policy is you want to, as I try to testify to, is you want to consider whether or not the policy is actually authorizing activity or whether it's regulation and oversight. And when I went through Measure 91 and I did look at all the provisions of it, most of them are about regulation and oversight currently, and I do think that there were some indications in the findings section or in the non-applicability section, excuse me, about how the measure wasn't intended to affect certain sectors of law. So I think that that's a pretty good starting point. I don't know if it is enough of a starting point, but it is something to consider when you're thinking about the policy. The holding in Emerald Steel is quite broad, but the factual circumstances that led to the holding were fairly narrow. And so I would encourage you to also think about those factual circumstances. The factual circumstances were in the context of an employer-employee relationship where the employer did not want to do something and referenced the federal law as a reason that he did not want to do it. So those circumstances or those factual circumstances are fairly narrow, and that should also provide you maybe with some guidance when you're coming up with a policy for this issue.
Okay, last one.
Madam Chair, last question. I am a big fan of the 10th Amendment. Well, I'd like to see it applied elsewhere, too.
Right.
private citizens can bring a complaint under the Racketeering Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act for either federal violations or state violations. Has anybody considered some sort of a risk analysis for ordinary citizens who don't like the outcome to basically bring a private action under the RICO statutes in federal civil, federal criminal, or state civil, or state criminal courts? Has anybody given that some thought?
Co-Vice Chair Farioli, I have not, but I would be happy to research that issue for you.
Madam Chair, I think that as we move forward, I think people may have forgotten that ordinary citizens can bring actions that are significant actions and possibly including treble damages, criminal filings, and others under RICO statutes. And perhaps we ought to consider, if we're going to proceed for implementation, that that is an issue we should be thinking about as well.
I'll look forward to your research. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up on the good question that Senator Farioli asked, and that is on the identification of the items in the Cole memo, and I want to confirm my reading of Measure 91. And my reading is that Section 1, Subsection 2, essentially restates the provisions that are identified in the Cole memo. Is that all?
Representative Helm, correct. I can't remember if it's Section 1 or Section 2, but there are findings that basically do restate the Cole Memorandum priorities.
Okay. Thank you. That's all.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. We will move now to our next panel, which is the OLCC. Mr. Patridge, Mr. Marks, and Mr. Burns.
I don't know about this group.
Like
I know.
Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Co-Chair Burdick and Co-Chair Leininger and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rob Patridge. I am the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm joined today at the dais with Steve Marks, who is the executive director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, as well as Tom Burns, who is the director of our marijuana program at the OLCC. As you're aware, in November, voters passed Measure 91. That put the responsibility at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission for implementing the process of putting the rules in place to bring this to Oregonians to start licensing in applications by January 4th, 2016. It's the OLCC's intent to continue to do that in a rapid manner, but taking into account also the spirit of the measure, while at the same time as Oregonians went out and collected signatures to put this on the ballot, Oregonians also didn't have the benefit of seeing what had happened in Colorado and Washington. We now have the benefit of over a year now of experience there, and we feel it's our responsibility also at the OLCC to continue to look at what's happened in Washington and Colorado to avoid any adverse impacts to Oregonians while still keeping within the spirit of the measure that we are trying to implement rules for. Certainly, Measure 91, just to give a history for those of you who aren't on the Ways and Means Committee, we came before the Ways and Means Committee. We came before the emergency board and obtained funding for four staff immediately thereafter in December, which authorized a loan of $583,000 from the liquor fund for startup costs. In January, the commission started its public input process with listening sessions around the state. The first two of those sessions were held in Baker City and Pendleton. We had sessions this week in Salem and Eugene. Nearly 1,000 people have attended those sessions. The remainder will take place between now and the middle of March. We plan on an additional 8 listening sessions. A couple of those we haven't announced to the public yet because we haven't secured the venues yet. The implementation of Measure 91 and what we've done is clearly on the minds of Oregonians, as we can tell. The agency's marijuana website, which I would encourage members if they haven't visited, as well as members of the public who may be listening, marijuana.oregon.gov, is a single clearinghouse site the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is utilizing, and we would ask you to send constituents there as well. It has information. You just discussed the Cole Memorandum. It has a copy of the Cole Memorandum. It has a copy of various materials surrounding marijuana, as well as upcoming dates, and we will put our rules as we move into our rules process there. That website, marijuana.oregon.gov, has received over 154,000 visits since November 5th. We have nearly 10,000 people who have subscribed to our listserv specifically for marijuana-related items.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pazanski.
I was going to ask Rob to kind of back off the mic because Sorry. You're getting a lot of feedback. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
And the listening sessions, as we can tell, have been well attended and very lively. We had about a little over 500 people, we believe, in our session in Eugene last night. Last night our mics didn't work, so maybe I'm overcrowding.
Compensating.
These are sensitive mics,
yes.
So just keep your distance.
Yeah.
We've
also,
Robbie, so
what's that?
We've upgraded them since.
I can tell. Also, more than 16,000 people responded to our one-week online survey that was on the OLCC's website. The survey provided the OLCC with the information we wanted to have before we went out on the road to hold these listening sessions and gave us really important information we saw, while not scientific, about the questions that we need to dig into. In digging into the results of the survey, it was clear that there is an expectation on the part of those responded that a regulated recreational marijuana industry will create economic opportunity, diminish the black market, and in hopes of generating revenue. The survey also showed that those expectations need to be weighed against concerns about public safety and exposing children to marijuana. That was the number one concern. Other issues raised by the survey were relating to DUIs, recreational marijuana and its effect on the medical community were some of the issues that we were able to tease out as a result of that survey and what we've heard locally. Going forward, the rulemaking process will begin in March, is our current plan, so that the OLCC can begin accepting applications for licensees in January of 2016, as required by the Measure 91. The expectation is that the agency will approve licenses for growers first, and then move through the various levels, so growers, producers, or growers, processors, wholesalers, and then retailers, so that we have a path to market that makes sense, and we don't end up in the situation that the state of Washington had, where they had retailers and no product. That didn't make a lot of sense to us and would encourage the black market. We hope that retail sales can begin in late 2016. We say that for the benefit of the fact that we have to license the growers. They have to grow the product. It has to be properly processed, tested, and all the things that need to happen and packaged. Then it has to move to the retail market. So we are trying to move rapidly, and we are certainly not trying to slow the process down, but tilting up a brand new set of rules in a year-long period is a pretty big task. The commission at this point in time it plans to come to the legislature to ask for an approximately $880,000 for this biennia to run the marijuana program. We're going to ask for additional staff, and we're also going to ask for some money for education because of the fact that the program will stand up in July 1st of 2015 with home grow operations, and we've received a lot of input related to that. The governor's recommended budget for this upcoming biennium asks for $7.1 million to run the program from 2015 to 2017. Obviously, that is a moving target because whatever happens in this committee, as well as we continue to learn more. The governor's budget anticipates $16.5 million in revenue, which was from the Legislative Revenue Office. However, we believe that there are a lot of variables that need to be considered in estimating the revenue, including local measures that may ban marijuana, consumption levels, prices, and the impact on the July 1st, 2015 start of home grows, and whatever actions you as the legislature take this session. One of the biggest elements of the OLCC's oversight of the regulated marijuana market is an inventory tracking system that tracks marijuana from when it is planted to when it is sold at the retail outlet. This seed-to-sale software is being used in Colorado and Washington for recreational side, and is being considered by other states, and currently there's RFPs out to utilize it on the medical marijuana tracking side. We believe, as the OLCC, that this system is vital to meet the points that were brought up earlier related to the Cole Memorandum to comply with the federal guidance. We're going to have a seed-to-sale tracking system. We have put out an RFI for the seed-to-sale tracking system. That process is complete. We are now evaluating that information as regarding the request for information, and are preparing an RFP that we will be putting forward, that we were going to ask for legislative approval for that. We've also are continuing to look at the we're continuing to look at Measure 91. You already heard from DOJ lawyer Shannon O'Fallon. We're working with DOJ, who is the lawyer for the OLCC. We're looking at a variety of practices and things happening in other states to try and lay out for you as this committee things that we need to have done. The OLCC expects shortly to come back to your committee with a series of not only technical fixes related to Measure 91 that we may have. We'll come back with the technical fixes. We'll come back with recommendations from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission related to ideas that we believe this committee should adopt related to making the process work correctly. And third and finally, we're going to bring back to this committee a series of items that are for your consideration, that are policy items, but that have been brought out and teased out as a result of our public outreach around the state to notify you what we're hearing and questions and concerns and opportunities people may see in the future. We look forward to working very closely with this legislative committee as we continue to move forward. We look forward to working together on those rules that this committee may not be, that may be clear that this committee is not going to go down that path, so that we can implement in a diligent and respectful way that maximizes public input, balancing out the spirit of this particular measure. So that's what we have for you today. I'm going to turn it over to Steve Marks, the Executive Director.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Marks.
Madam Chair, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. Appreciate the opportunity to be here, this responsibility. And as Rob outlined here, there's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done. We look forward to trying to match your pace, the pace of Ways and Means, and our own commission's pace to put this in place for the people of Oregon. With that, I'm not going to take any more of your time tonight, but get right over to Tom Burns to talk about the medical program.
Thank you. Mr. Burns.
Madam Chair, representatives, senators, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Medical, wrong title, sorry, Director of Marijuana for the Oregon Health, I'll get it right, yeah, for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I ran the medical marijuana program for the OHA in a previous life, and Steve Marks grabbed me and brought me over here. Actually, I asked to come over here. I thought it would be interesting to continue the work. I thought I'd just a few things. This is like an onion. I mean, I listened to Shannon, I listened to Mark today, and I thought, oh, they've opened another layer of an onion that I hadn't thought about, and I'm going to have to address in the rules or come up with something that we need to set as a policy. And the line I'm using today is, I hope I get the onion peeled before I burst into tears. Mm-hmm. This is really a very complicated process, and I think it's important for you to understand a few things. So I'm going to put sort of two hats on. Talk about a little bit about the medical side that I used to run, and contrast that with the Measure 91 side. I think the first thing to understand is, on the medical side, the only regulation that occurs on the medical side for supply is the for the business is the public-facing dispensaries. The entire product that is in those dispensaries, OHA has no authority over. Now, they do say that they license certain growers, but what that grower does, how that product is handled, how that product is moved, how that product is tested, how that product is processed, is something that OHA has no authority over. And that's an important distinction compared to Measure 91, where it's quite clear that under Measure 91, OLCC governs everything from the seed when it's planted all the way through the sale to the final consumer. And the various licenses give the OLC the authority to govern those areas. I think that's an important distinction, because as we built the medical program, we kept looking at issues and saying, oh, we'd really like to test the product. Wait, we don't have authority to test the product. How do we get to it? We'd really like to know how the grower is growing the product. Well, we didn't govern the growers. So what you have currently is, or heading towards, are two parallel systems, with the public-facing storefronts being regulated by two separate agencies, and the supply chain on the recreational side being governed by OLCC, and the supply chain on the medical side being governed by nobody. Now, we did attempt to reach back by rule and sort of put some authority and do some testing stuff and do some control about edibles and things like that, but it was a difficult process to get to, and I know that three of you were on that Rules Advisory Committee, and you suffered through with me sort of the problems that we had in building that. I think the other thing that I think is important is, there was a conversation about grows on the medical side. And I think it's important for you to know that there are when the medical system started, it started with a one-on-one relationship. I designated Rob as my grower because I lived in an apartment and he had ground and he could grow for me, or I was too ill to grow and he could grow for me. And so we had a one-on-one relationship. There are 24,500 of those relationships identified. The patient says, I am designating somebody to be my grower, and it's a one-on-one relationship. 24,500 of those. It then goes up. It falls significantly. A two-to-one relationship. This may be a husband and wife growing for somebody. 5,700 of those. 3-to-1, 2,300. 4-to-1, 1,200. All the way up to, we start getting to 30 patients per grower. And that's if you multiply that, that's 180 plants, by the way. We have one of those. We have one grow that has 104 patients registered at that grower site.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, can you explain that a little more? Listening to Shannon, I thought it was a limit of four.
It is a limit of, so if I designate Rob as my grower, he can grow six plants for me. You could designate Rob as my grower, as your grower, and he could grow six more plants. And we can continue that until he reached a total of four patients. Then Steve, on the same physical location, could grow for four different people. So the two of them are now growing 48 plants, and you keep expanding that up. And this is a contrast against the recreational side, where there's a policy question about how big the groves ought to be. And this is one of the things that you may want to wrestle with, or we may have to wrestle with, of how large should a grow be. We've heard from the listening tours we went on that the people who are attending want this to be a small family farm operation. If we don't limit the number of plants, we will not be able to protect those small farmers. That's a policy question you have to decide. On the medical side, if we don't limit the number of plants that are grown in the medical system, we may have an overabundance of product on the medical side that creates a problem if there is not enough demand in the medical dispensaries to absorb that product. And that becomes a policy question that has to be resolved. I know it's not a Measure 91 question, but it is tangential to Measure 91, because if we're going to build a recreational system and know how much marijuana is in that recreational system, and we have a medical system on the sideline, what we don't know, we may have a problem. I went to Colorado. I know the co-chairs went to Colorado, and that was their single biggest, largest message to us. It was, control the grow on your medical side. Who controls it, what agency controls it, how it's controlled it, that's a policy question you have to decide. But that was the message that came back, is control the grow. The other thing that is real clear that is going on out there is the whole issue of testing. We attempted to make testing in the medical side so that when the patient consumed the product, they knew that the product was safe, that it did not have pesticides in it, that it did not have molds or mildew on it. We wanted to be able to tell the patient how much THC or CBD, the chemicals that help the patient, was in that product. Because we didn't govern the labs, we had to require the dispensary owner to do that. And that left the dispensary owner at the to go out and try and find a lab that would test their product and to come back with a result that was an acceptable result. If the result was not an honest result, there was no way that we, as the OHA, had any ability to reach that lab. We could reach the dispensary, but we couldn't reach the lab. What that does is, either on the medical side or the recreational side, it places the consumer at risk. And so on the recreational side, we believe we can get to the labs. We can require the labs to be certified by a state agency that says, yes, you are a laboratory. You meet all the standards of any laboratory in the state. And then by rule or by direction from you, tell the laboratories what needs to be tested. But that's not something we can do on the recreational, on the medical side. Concentrates is a big policy question that you will have to address. Concentrate is where you take the non-flour and you run it through a machine. Those machines contain butane or propane or CO2 or water. Sometimes those machines, if not worked properly, tend to blow up. Butane is a very flammable product, and it is a process that you do tend to heat. One of the questions that we're wrestling with is how to control that, and can we control that with our current authority. But the makers of concentrates provide a service to a large number of both medical and recreational consumers. Fewer and fewer people are actually taking the bud these days and smoking it the way some of us from a certain generation may have done in our college days, where you roll it in a joint and it was a leaf. People are now learning that you can take it, concentrate it into an oil, put it in an e-cigarette, for lack of a better term, and smoke it that way. So you don't have the odor, you don't have the fire, you don't have the extra carcinogenics that you may inhale by burning a product. So that is a market that is becoming very popular, and we will have to figure out what to do with that. Concentrates then leads to the conversation of edibles. When I was putting the medical program in place, I proposed after one of our rules advisory committees that we were going to ban edibles because I didn't understand them. They didn't make any sense to us. They were an area where we saw the gummy bears and we saw the marijuanas and the brightly colored candies, the brownies and the brightly colored candies, and we said, let's just not do that. I have never had so many emails or phone calls yelling at me for ending the edible side of the medical program. What I learned was, on medical, there are a large number of patients who cannot smoke or inhale a product, that they need to put something in their mouth that they can suck on and absorb that, take their medicine that way. I get it on the medical side. On the recreational side, you have a policy question. If you go to Colorado, you will see old products that look, it says Kit Kat, which is one of my favorite candy bars, spelled with a C instead of a K. Kit Kat is spelled K-A-T-C-A-T. It's just reversed. It looks exactly the same. Peanut butter cups. That is a problem if we are going to address kids. And so that's a policy question that you will have to wrestle with and that we are wrestling with as we try and write the rules. I think I'll stop there. Shannon did a very good job of contrasting the two sort of programs. I can expand on this. We have a long ways to go on this. We'll be happy to provide whatever you desire. I think when we ultimately release the rules sometime after our listening session, it will also give you a basis of some of the policy questions we're thinking about and seeing, and the list that Chair Patridge mentioned of coming up with technical changes and fixes. We need to get to you sooner rather than later, so that you can start thinking about tweaking some of these things. Like, OLCC cannot currently hold any marijuana. Well, if we're investigating a site and we see some extra product that is not in the system, what do we do with that? Do we call local law enforcement and wait? In the meantime, they walk out the door with it because we at OLCC can't possess it, or we're doing a minor decoy and we want to see whether they'll sell to a minor and we have to walk out of the store as an OLCC employee carrying marijuana? We can't do that. There's these little tweaks that need to fit in there. The rules will identify some of these. Our list of changes will identify some of these. And I think that we will be happy to sit here with you on many an evening trying to figure all this out. Thank you.
I know the three of you will be back, and we'll take questions in a minute. But Chair Patridge, I know that you have to drive, so feel free to excuse yourself anytime you want. Other questions, Senator Beyer?
Just real quickie. What's your sense of timing when you'll be able to give us some synthesis of the surveys, the listening sessions you've been doing, and on to the recommendations and issues?
So I think the plan at OLCC currently is, I think we can provide you the survey information, and I think we've provided it to some of you individually related to the, and we can get that to you immediately, related to the kind of a summary of those listening sessions. I think that we've got some of them going into March, but what I anticipate is that the OLCC will adopt some type of list of
some of the recommendations that we may have, the technical fixes and some of the recommendations, as well as maybe some of the initial considerations at our February OLCC meeting, which is in about 3 weeks. We just haven't had time with the limited staffing we've had, and I don't want to speak as the chair or have individual members. I'd like to have the OLCC come before the committee and say, as a group, this is what we're considering. We did vote, for example, on Friday. We heard a local law enforcement panel, as well as from Anthony, who is one of the proponents of 91, who you're going to hear from, I think, here in a minute, and growers and other people. We did come with a recommendation and voted that we would like the commission or the committee to consider giving the OLCC some type of peace officer authority so that we can deal with some of the issues if we come across marijuana in a, you know, an abundance of marijuana or missing marijuana, that we can freeze the scene and do the things that we need to do in order to have some public credibility that we're actually have an enforcement mechanism there to make things happen. You know, part of what we also realize, however, balancing that out, is part of the reason this measure passed was from a civil libertarian standpoint, and to protect people's civil liberties and not put them into the criminal side of the system. And we need the investigative tools so we don't throw people into the criminal system if we don't need to. So that's we want to work with the committee certainly on that, and we certainly want to work on a variety of other issues that we plan to bring to you as soon as we can.
Thank you. Other questions?
I do, Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
So one of the statements I heard struck, a chord and perhaps a chill of fear in me, and that's that Oregon Liquor Control Commission is going to be developing a new state IT program. That's going to be fun to watch you do the tracking system.
Is it on the shelf? Just tell us it's
no,
on the shelf.
Gosh, no, because it's a budget $300 million for that, Madam Chair. So, Chair Patridge, you are assuming that growers don't already have enough product to meet the initial need. And we, the inference is that growers are perhaps producing more than the medical system can absorb. Is there any provision that you know of in Measure 91 that would allow a transfer of medical product into the recreational product? And I point that out as a logistical question because Mr. Patridge assumes that we need time for a crop to mature. You know, and the fact of the matter is there's millions of dollars worth of marijuana growing in thousands of locations in Oregon. So do we have a provision for making a transfer of medical into recreational to meet the initial demand without having a growing season intervene?
Co-chairs and Senator Farioli, we do not have a provision because we don't have any of the rules written at this point in time. Do we have the authority to do that? That's certainly something we are looking at, and I will tell you it has come up in some of our listening sessions that why don't we allow that to come over. However, by the same time, we don't want a bunch of people running around out there now setting up grows all around the state under the auspices of a medical system and creating a false market with the anticipation that they can then move that over so they can get into the cycle 90 days ahead of time. We've heard from a variety of advocates on both sides, and it's been interesting as we've had these green, yellow, and red cards, what people want to do at these listening sessions related to keep your hands off or we want partially in, so it's a variety of issues.
And Madam Chair, just a couple of other questions. The OLCC, if it's a designated holding agency, it's also a warehousing agency under the authority of BATF. Is there a conflict between the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco, because you're a bonded warehouse, and you mentioned that there seemed to be no authority for storing in any OLCC facilities. So do you also have a potential conflict with the BATF on becoming a dual agency?
Co-chairs and Senator Farioli, while I'm not intimately familiar with the BATF law regarding this, the Measure 91 prohibits the OLCC from holding any marijuana. In talking with people, my understanding was to make that clear that they didn't want the OLCC to be the
the distribution point as we are for alcohol. What we are, to clarify what the commission talked about, we need the ability to at least freeze a scene, seize excess marijuana till we can figure out where it came from, is our belief as a regulatory agency and a regulatory body. It's not for distribution purposes. It's merely to for investigative purposes. So I don't believe that that would be in violation of any BATF laws, that as a having peace officer authority, we have the ability to seize it, freeze it, and hold on to it. But we're not going to be selling it back into the system. So we wouldn't be in violation of BATF law, I don't believe.
Madam Chair, final question. This may be for any of the three wise men here, the three wise men. Perhaps, though, for Mr. Marks, what's the alcohol business worth to Oregon in a biennium?
Chair Burdick and Senator Farioli, about $1.1 million moving to $1.2 billion in sales.
So, Madam Chair, the follow-up is, have you formed an opinion about what the size of the recreational marijuana business will be relative to the alcohol business? Will it be bigger, or will it not be bigger?
I'll take that on. There's been a lot of estimates out there about what our market looks like. We haven't decided what that looks like as Oregonians. You haven't set your parameters in place. We don't know exactly what the recreational outlets are going to look like. There has been some market analysis of how much consumption is going on in Oregon. We can provide you with some numbers of that as we've looked at them. But in terms of the market by sales and dollars that we bring in, the estimates are very wide, and I'd say for this Oregon program, we don't really have a clarity about what it's going to be on a biennial or annual basis once we put it together.
Madam Chair, I'd love to have any comparators or analysis that you have about the size of both. You know, because I'm interested to find out whether or not we're going to see a system rapidly expanding beyond the current system, or one that runs sort of parallel to it. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you for the questions.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just kind of curious what Senator Farioli just said. I mean, for Steve, and that I don't know why we wouldn't be able to kind of look and compare notes with what Colorado and Washington's already done. You know, I mean that. Yeah, you're going to be in a pickle to try to do that, I think.
I suppose you could make some estimates.
Yeah, you could question that.
We will. I'm sure we will be getting more information. But the one thing we did find in Colorado is their medical population has increased rather substantially.
People have gotten sicker.
Hence Mr. Burns' comments.
Because of the taxing system.
Because of the taxes.
The taxes.
Yeah.
In the sense of increased taxes. That's why we need to keep ours low.
Yes, I agree.
Does somebody... Mr. Marks.
Madam Chair and Representative Olson, I just want to follow up. We can provide you all the information on the different estimates that are out there, the basis on which those estimates have been made and sort of what the users are. But, you know, which one you pick and choose and which one reflects our Oregon system is really a question mark here.
That really is the question of the day. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, our final witness today is the one and only Chief Petitioner of Measure 91. Welcome, Anthony. Anthony, do you think you'll be able to do your remarks in about 15 minutes?
Definitely.
Perfect.
I will not take up too much of your time. Madam Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Anthony Johnson. I live in Portland, Oregon. I was chief petitioner of Measure 91 and one of the co-authors, and I can see that some people blame me for adding this work, while other people praise me for adding this work to the state of Oregon. So you're welcome, or I apologize, which side you're on. First, I somewhat want to give kind of overview of the movement of advocacy to end really criminal penalties and move towards legalization of marijuana really across the country. And it's really a movement that's decades in the making and in many ways started right here in this building in 1973 when the Oregon legislature was the first state to decriminalize personal amounts of marijuana.
We weren't here then.
So I can't blame you guys personally, but your predecessors.
Back off a little bit.
Sorry. And now we have over half the country living in decriminalized states or in medical marijuana states. And we see poll after poll, a majority of Americans now want to end cannabis prohibition, marijuana prohibition, and move towards regulating marijuana, much like beer and wine, much like alcohol. And we are now, we have four states, District of Columbia, that have legalized marijuana, and we're likely to have at least four states, maybe as many as eight states with legalization measures on the ballot in 2016, most likely being California to our south. Nevada already has qualified a legalization measure on the ballot, Massachusetts, New Mexico, likely as well. And so as a country, you know, we're moving towards treating marijuana like beer and wine and not wasting what we would call, you know, wasting or diverting resources and priorities that could be utilized elsewhere. And I got my start in this cause over 15 years ago at the University of Missouri because I saw my African-American friends treated more harshly than my white friends for marijuana. Whenever there was a marijuana encounter or arrest, they would end up being treated harshly, not more harshly. And that actually plays out in a place even like Oregon, where people of color are more likely to be arrested or cited for marijuana, even though across races there's no difference in uses. And there's also a poverty aspect of it. When you are poor, can't afford legal counsel, you're more likely to suffer negative legal consequences. And of course, everybody seems to love, you know, Willie Nelson, and nobody wants to see Willie Nelson in jail. But I think if you watch the news, you often see Willie Nelson arrested for marijuana. If Willie Nelson was Joe Smith without platinum records, I think he would be serving prison time at some point in his life. And I think that as we move forward in this state, I think we want to move more and more towards beer and wine and not seeing people who are using marijuana any differently than anybody that wants to use have a Total Domination IPA or an Oregon-grown Pinot Noir. And so that was really our basis for Measure 91. And Measure 91 was a process that really took longer than two years. We actually, a few of us, started working on Measure 91 even before Oregon voted on legalization in 2012. The legalization measure in 2012 didn't have any limits on how many people could grow. The age limit was 18 instead of 21, and would have created a new cannabis commission. And polling that we had done and many had done showed that the measure wasn't going to pass muster with Oregon voters. So we started even before that, listening to voters through polling, through focus groups, proposing a bill that was introduced in the legislature. It was the first legalization measure to ever get a hearing in Oregon, was House Bill 3371. And we learned a lot from listening to legislators, people that work in substance abuse treatment programs, law enforcement, former and current. You know, we even met with people that we knew were not going to support us. We wanted to hear their point of view. We wanted to address the concerns. And the concerns that everybody has about keeping marijuana in the hands of kids, about keeping our roads safe, having a safe product, we as advocates completely share those views. Because we know if there are bad consequences, the voter backlash and federal interference can undo a lot of work that we have accomplished. And so we really want to work with the state to implement the common sense rules and get the basics in place for Measure 91 around testing, around the child proofing, around no marketing towards kids, about giving the OLCC the time and the peace officer powers that they need, especially if those peace officer powers are a way that we can deal with marijuana in a civil aspect instead of a criminal aspect. What I would urge people, and here there are a couple lawyers on the committee. I'm a former criminal defense attorney myself. I like to call myself a recovering attorney, you know, taking it one day at a time. I would hope that you would look at Measure 91 really with an eye towards like strict scrutiny, that if you're going to change major aspects of Measure 91, that it's that there's proof and evidence that it's really needed. And if there's no proof and evidence of that, let's deal with those issues in future sessions. And let's not change the local taxation, the local opt-out, and let's not infringe upon the things that we talked about that Measure 91 laid out as far as keeping the medical marijuana program safe and secure under the Oregon Health Health Authority, as an advocate, I'm still concerned about future administrations, what they may do to our medical program if it's too intertwined with the OLCC. And at the same time, you know, the medical program deals with 70,000 patients, and we need to think about the patients first, and they shouldn't be really thought of as an economic engine or a moneymaker like what the OLCC is going to have under Measure 91. I look forward to thousands of jobs being created, millions of dollars being generated for the state, but if we're a medical program, that really shouldn't be the focus of our state. Our focus should be on meeting the needs of the patients, and so I urge the committee and the OLCC, let's get the basics of Measure 91 first, let's implement it, and then tackle more things as we go along. So I thank you so much for your time. I thank you so much for your work. And I look forward to rolling out something that Oregon can definitely be proud of.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. That was a good presentation.
Thank you.
Okay. That concludes our agenda. Our next meeting will be on Monday, and we will take up the issue of laboratory testing and children programs to protect children. Madam Co-Chair, do you want to expand on that?
Sure. Well, I'm pleased to hear to have heard Tom and the OLCC folks and then Anthony talk about the fact that reasonable testing in order to make sure product in both the medical and in the adult use recreational arenas is safe. And I think that we have, by both of your recognitions, we have some room for improvement to make sure that we have a sensible system that's evenly applied, that yields product that everyone can rely on as safe. So we're going to be looking at some of the issues around that subject, and then we're going to be looking also at Colorado put some money up front into prevention education for youth, so marijuana use prevention education for youth as part of their rollout of the program. They didn't start that until 7 months in to their program, and one of the pieces of advice we heard when we went out there was start soon, start last week. You know, it's a good investment to make as you try to move through this, to be investing in helping our kids understand that this is not for them. So we're going to look at some models and some input from people on things that they think we should consider.
Thank you. So that's our preview for the next meeting. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next week. We are adjourned. We'll see you next week. We are adjourned.